My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagrids, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. As we announced on Friday, when we did a quick extra episode on the recent events taking place in the Middle East, today is Sunday, and we are recording now our longer regular weekly episode on the topic, and we truly hope that Sunday 10 a.m. That nothing will happen in the next few days that will seriously make everything that we're saying right now invalid by Wednesday.
Good luck with that, right? With the space with which things go. I am actually relatively concerned that right after recording, I will have to send you a message saying, Dario, we have to record again because nuclear explosion has occurred somewhere or something of that nature.
Well, let's hope not. So for the listeners who missed our Friday episode, just because it was, right, it's not the usual Western Bubble time. It's not Wednesday, Wednesday at midnight. We spent about 20 minutes kind of giving a quick update on what happened starting Friday, right? And so for the listeners who have been living under a rock, which I don't think any of them do, on Friday, we saw Israel actually attack the Islamic Republic of Iran with fighter jets, with drones, with covert operations within Iran through the Mossad. It was a large-scale military attack on another country, and they targeted Iran's nuclear facilities, nuclear scientists, and the senior leadership of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And we already talked about this on Friday, but this is an act of war by one country against another country, right?
It absolutely is. It is an act of war. And weirdly enough, people don't seem to really care about that because it is Israel versus Iran, right? Certainly when I say people in the West, people in Western media, there seems to be some kind of weird sense that because Iran might be a existential threat to Israel, right? If they develop nuclear weapons and if they were to use those nuclear weapons, those are a bit too big ifs. But if that automatically legitimizes for Israel to just bomb Iran whenever it likes. Obviously, that's not how the real world works. This is not how international relations works. This idea of preemptive attacks against a potential threat doesn't make any sense when you think about it for longer than 2 minutes. And so, yes, Iran is now the victim of an act of war by Israel. And somehow people don't really seem to care about that.
Well, I mean, let's think about this for longer than 2 minutes, because I had this conversation just yesterday with a friend of mine who is a firm believer that this falls under Israel's right for self-defense, right? And this kind of comes from the Six Days War, where beforehand, like Israel has engaged in preemptive strikes. And I mean, international law in that sense is not really, I mean, I don't think there has been any super conclusive, opinion on the Six Days War, at least. With this one, I think I would be a bit quicker, but let's think about this for longer than 2 minutes. Why is a preemptive strike like this, if you can call it preemptive, stupid?
Yeah, well, first of all, the international law doesn't really have an opinion on wars as such. They just look at whether, you know, it's just a method to check whether rules are broken or not. This is, so the problem with preemptive rules, wars is that if you take a step back and think about it from a different perspective, because most people who seem to be okay with everything that's happening are okay with it because they have sympathy for Israel and they dislike Iran, right? That's the key component. Also, this idea Israel is a democracy or a semi-democracy, and Iran is an authoritarian theocracy. And that already in our Western bubble mentality makes the case for Iran not having the same rights as Israel. So Israel is allowed to do whatever it likes because of its nature against the evil inherent nature of Iran. And there's nothing that Iran can claim as long as it is this authoritarian regime. That is the Western bubble mentality. But if you then take a step back and say, okay, let's forget about Iran and Israel. How about a seemingly absurd case, but it's actually not a crazy case at all. How about China says Taiwan is part of China, one China. This has been clearly established and we are convinced of this. And the pesky Americans with their 7th Fleet going into the Taiwanese Strait all the time are messing things up. So let's preemptively strike the Americans because we have a right to control Taiwan. People would say that's outrageous. How dare you strike against the American armed forces? That is an act of war. Well, yeah, it is, exactly. Because China just subjectively deciding that that fleet is a threat does not mean that it has a right to start organized violence, right? So most people in that situation would say, yeah, obviously China cannot attack the American 7th Fleet. And of course, the United States has then every right to retaliate with everything it's got, obviously. But that is exactly what is happening now with Israel and Iran as well, with the difference that Israel is the democratic regime. And Iran is the authoritarian regime, whereas in the case of China versus the United States, China is the authoritarian regime, and the United States is the democratic regime. That's the only difference here. Besides that, the process is exactly the same.
But Balder, aren't you concerned that Iran has been this close, and again, I'm pinching my fingers together very closely, to developing a nuclear weapon for the last 20 to 40 years now? I mean, they've really been this close.
Yeah. It was the first thing I heard when I was a toddler about international relations in 1981. I heard, oh, the Mossad has just published this report. Iran, a few months, and they're that close. It's been a few months since 1981, but yeah, that means that they must be even closer now. I should have taken a tally of my students over the past 10 years that I've been teaching at university, the students who were convinced that Iran already has nuclear weapons, because we're so often talking about they're this close, that essentially in our world, Iran has nuclear weapons, they're ready to strike. And it's those two steps that are almost emotionally assumed by people, whereas, first of all, obviously there's no evidence that they are this close, obviously. There has not been serious evidence since 1981, and that's why since 1981 they haven't been this close. But secondly, people don't ask the question of, all right, let's say that they were to develop nuclear weapons. Would that then allow for a total annihilation of the country? No, you know what? Pakistan, North Korea, India, China, Israel itself all have nuclear weapons. That is in itself not a reason to then immediately strike against Iran. Yes, the non-proliferation regime is falling apart. So globally, nuclear weapons are becoming more popular. If Iran were to join that club, and that's a big if, then that still doesn't legitimize military action against them. And by the way, it would not necessarily mean at all that Iran would offensively use them against Israel. There's absolutely no reason to believe that Iran would do that.
I mean, I think here, I can't believe I have to argue the other side right now. I mean, based on the rhetoric that the Ayatollah, right, and the government has been using, I mean, right, they do call for the total annihilation of Israel. So, I mean, if they, let's say I could understand someone who is inside the Western bubble to think that, okay, right, if you use it with this rhetoric, that you might also use it that way. However, I don't want to engage in that argument because I think it's pointless. A more interesting thing is, I think I said this on Friday already to you before the recording, but we didn't record about it. If I was an advisor to the Ayatollah right now, I would definitely, like, and again, this is still not, like, I don't buy the argument that Iran is developing a nuclear weapon, right? But if I was an advisor right now, I would definitely advise Iran to get a nuclear weapon. Because, I mean, hey, Israel has been walking all over you for the last years. And an attack like this will not happen if you as Iran have a nuclear weapon to defend yourself.
Yeah, obviously. Now, let me just for a second go back to the fact that Iran has been calling for the annihilation of Israel. I mean, yes, it's very clear that they are two enemies. There's no doubt about that. But that doesn't mean that Iran is a suicidal regime that actually is interested in using nuclear weapons to achieve that goal. We don't even know to what extent it is actually a goal or whether it's just that rhetoric, right? Whether it's a narrative, a discourse that also legitimizes the regime as the one regime standing up to Israel. But let's assume, yes, It is true, absolutely, that they have used incredibly aggressive and potentially existentially threatening language against Israel. No doubt about that. By the way, so is Israel towards the Iranian government, but that's by the by. Let's assume that tomorrow they do develop nuclear weapons. Then that doesn't mean that automatically, as some kind of crazy animal, Iran will just explode nuclear weapons in Tel Aviv or elsewhere. Iran has actually shown that it's very, very careful in the way that it reacts towards Israel. One of the reasons why it's always Israel engaging in military action and Iran then retaliating is that Iran does not want to open the door to a full-scale war. And obviously, if Iran were to ever use nuclear weapons against Israel, Israel would strike back with nuclear weapons and the United States would strike back and there would be a full-blown war, which would be the end of the Iranian government. So just to push back on those assumptions that yes, they use rhetoric against Israel, that doesn't mean that those nuclear weapons are automatically going to be used. Now, to your second point, which is the much more interesting point in at this moment, namely that Iran has consistently said, but that could just be a lie, I mean, that could just be perfectly untrue, but they've consistently said it goes against our faith to develop nuclear weapons. It goes against our religion. It goes against the will of God. We are not developing nuclear weapons. Right now, any strategic analyst in Tehran who's in the know, if it is actually true that because of religion, if their words are true, which is a bit if, but if they haven't even thought about developing nuclear weapons, then now as a strategic analyst, you will be shouting at the Ayatollah, please, please let us develop nuclear weapons, because this can't continue. The only reason why Israel can do what it does is because the balance of power is completely uneven. It's only because they essentially can get away with this because they know that, yes, Iran has missiles. Yes, Iran can kill civilians, as they just did last night. Apparently 10 Israeli civilians died. But they do not have the military capability to really stand up to Israel. With nuclear weapons, that would be a different thing. With nuclear weapons, you would see a situation where if Israel pushes it too far, all of a sudden, they do threaten the use of nuclear weapons. Because at that moment, if Iran as a state is existentially threatened, then this dissuasion tactic of activating your nuclear arsenal becomes a thing. Exactly what you've seen with India and Pakistan, right? India and Pakistan have this sort of existential rivalry between each other. Before they both had nuclear weapons, there were three full-blown, full-scale wars, conventional wars against each other. Since then, what they've engaged in is skirmishes, knowing that if they push it too far, nuclear arsenals might actually come into play, and they want to avoid that. So, obviously, if you're Iranian now, you want to dissuade Israel from basically bullying you in the way that Israel has been bullying you, and this would be the way forward.
I have a question, because you've been talking about, right, the skirmishes. So between India and Pakistan, you had these three full-on wars, and then since then you've had skirmishes. Why does no one declare war on each other anymore? Because I keep on hearing myself say, oh, this is a declaration of war, right? Well, it's an act of war, and therefore it constitutes kind of war. Why does no one declare war on each other anymore? I mean, I grew up in history class with the images of kind of the paper boys, right, waving around the newspaper saying that war has been declared. Why is that no longer happening?
Yeah, that's a fascinating issue. Well, in some ways, we can blame the United States for this. The United States started essentially to declare war. The United States needs approval, or the White House needs approval from Congress. Of course, that can often be problematic. It can be slow. There can be resistance against it. So the White House basically has started developing over the past 50 years this habit of essentially sending military personnel engaging in the violence and then basically forcing Congress to start financing a full-blown war. Iraq is a very clear case of this in 2003, but this also happened already with Vietnam to a certain extent. So the United States sort of set the tone. But there is a bigger problem, which goes way beyond the United States and which is very visible in European media at the moment. We've talked about this in the past, and this is where my public service announcement every week comes in. Don't let people blur the lines between war and peace, right? Everywhere you read now that we're essentially at war with Russia, except that we're not fighting Russia yet, but it's neither peace nor war, and we have to defend because obviously Russia is gonna attack soon. We have to up our military because we all know that war is going to happen. We're essentially creating a world in which peace and war are interchangeable, and there's no clear distinction between them anymore. And that means that if at one point you find yourself fighting an enemy, then that's almost as if it's like a unavoidable thing that just happens without any process or decision making behind it. And then you can't help but continue the war in order to win, because surely you can't lose the war. This is a very, very scary element of 21st century international politics, where war is no longer a specific moment with a specific decision behind it. It just seems to occur. It just seems to happen. And the fact that Israel is allowed to do what it's doing without people saying, hey, you've just declared war in Iran, is a very good example of that.
I'm sorry that I'm jumping around within the conversation here. I do need to go back to the nuclear weapon and Iran. If Iran doesn't want to have a nuclear weapon, then why are they enriching uranium beyond the levels that are needed for civilian use, right? So, I mean, the kind of reason, or at least the cover that Netanyahu had to kind of call for these attacks, was that the International Atomic Energy Agency on Thursday issued a report, I think the board of the agency kind of decided that, yeah, Iran is actually in breach of the rules and obligations imposed by the non-proliferation agreement. Right, and they're at 60%, and they need, and this just like, you don't need that amount of uranium enriched to that percentage for any civilian use, right? And then the argument by the other side is always that, from 60 to 90%, it's only a matter of weeks. And then what they conveniently leave out is that a nuclear weapon needs testing. Attaching a nuclear a nuclear warhead to a missile is a very complex issue. So that the real number, instead of saying, Iran is, right, so what they always say is that, Iran is only weeks away from enriching uranium needed for a nuclear weapon. But what they always leave out is that, well, that means that they're still 9 to 12 months away from actually having a nuclear weapon. Right? Those are convenient numbers. But then still, like, the first question stands, why would you enrich uranium to 60%?
Well, the 12 months you happen, that would be a miracle. If you look at the North Korea case, North Korea has needed multiple tests throughout the years before they could actually declare, we've got something that might more or less function. And they're still not completely sure whether their nuclear weapons are properly equipped to actually be used in practice. So you're absolutely right. This is such a horrible aspect of the way that media and politicians talk about Iran. Yes, they are enriching uranium beyond civilian uses. At least that's what we know from the international agency that explores this. Now, they also...
And them I trust, I must say. Like, I trust an international agency. I have no reason to distrust them.
No, the only thing that you could argue is that there is a slight inherent bias, not necessarily willful, but bias, because, of course, they don't want to be caught with their pants down. If it turns out that they were underestimating Iranian efforts, then they will be criticized left, right, and center. So there is an inherent bias to kind of exaggerate any problems that they might see. But yeah, no, I don't think that they're necessarily a political actor in that sense. And they're certainly more trustworthy than anything that European governments or Israel or the United States say about Iran. So we know that they've been enriching uranium. But because we're continuously throwing these kinds of sentences out there, they're disclosed, we start internalizing this truth in our minds that essentially, at any moment, Iran might start striking with its nuclear weapons. And there's so many steps before they could even do that. And then there would be the question, would they even want to strike if they develop that? Why are they enriching uranium beyond that? Well, there are multiple explanations. Explanation one, scenario one, They are actually actively developing nuclear weapons, and they are hoping to get it as soon as possible. If so, they have been the most incompetent government in the world, because if North Korea can do it in 10 years, then Iran, with all its enormous technological and economic capacities, should be able to do that much, much better and much faster, right? Scenario two, they want to keep the possibility of developing nuclear weapons because they see the world in which North Korea lives now. North Korea was under continuous threat and sanctions and aggression, at least diplomatic and sometimes even military or covert aggression from its enemies. It develops nuclear weapons and all of a sudden the world backs off. Iran sees that and said, hey, maybe that's an opportunity. Maybe that's something we should at the very minimum consider. Scenario three is they don't really want to develop nuclear weapons. What they're saying is true, that they feel uncomfortable because of their religion. They feel uncomfortable because of their moral concerns, but they understand that they can use it as a negotiating tactic in conversations with the West. Basically say, hey, we are happy to reduce our enrichment program, but in exchange, we want you to stop sanctioning us. Because let's be clear, I mean, the Western sanctions against Iran are not really about the nuclear program. They're just because the West and Israel don't like Iran. It's not as if Iran all of a sudden, if all the uranium enrichment disappears, that all of a sudden the West says, oh, now you can be your friends and we will open up to you. No, of course not. The West hates Iran, and Iran wants to use uranium enrichment as a negotiating tool. And the fourth scenario is that it's misinterpreted somehow, that somehow what they're actually doing is part of their civilian program, and instead we are seeing ghosts when they don't exist. Now, I don't think that fourth scenario is very likely, but that could also be a possibility given the enormous bias that exists towards Iran, right? You see Iran do one little thing and immediately you start panicking about the potential consequences. Whereas if we saw Switzerland doing the same thing, we wouldn't worry at all about it because we think, oh, Switzerland is just engaging in scientific research.
I mean, it could be a decimal mistake, right? That they misunderstood that you only need 6% enriched uranium for civilian use, and they accidentally went for 60, right? That would I'm saying this because that would happen to me. It's the reason why I'm dabble in international relations, not to have to work with numbers.
A wrong decimal has led to people thinking that spinach is way better for you than it really is, right? Because the researchers put a wrong decimal for the level of iron that exists in spinach. Yeah, so just to be clear, I don't think that scenario is the most likely. I think it's more likely one of the other three, but my point here is that there are many lines of analysis that could explain the uranium enrichment without it immediately leading to, oh, they want to develop nuclear weapons, they're going to develop nuclear weapons, and they're going to use those nuclear weapons. Those are so many steps that require so much time and so many assumptions that it is much more likely that one of the other scenarios would be the answer. However, in our world, and certainly in Western media and Israeli media, they are not even considered. Obviously, Iran wants to have nuclear weapons, and obviously they're going to use them against Israel.
Well, maybe if they're so incompetent to take forever to develop a nuclear weapon, maybe we need to help them and enact some form of regime change. Right? I mean, it seems like that's what the Israelis are doing, at least. And I think with this, right, we can kind of move away from Iran towards Israel and talk about, talk about whether there is any strategy behind Israel's actions that we can see, that we can point at and say, okay, we see your thought process. Maybe there's a wrong assumption, or here you took a wrong turn. Because I quite frankly have a tough time understanding what Israel's strategic objectives are currently in the region, right? So since October 7th, in 2023, since the Hamas terrorist attack on the country, I mean, kind of starting in October 7th, it makes, like, I can observe this, and I mean, we talked about this extensively during the month of October, saying that It's likely that Israel will seek revenge, will want to kind of bring the perpetrators to justice, return the hostages, and to a certain degree incapacitate Hamas because they are a threat right at the border. I remember we warned against that in October and saying that, hey, don't lash out now, right? Don't make the same mistakes that the United States did after 9/11. This is the 9/11 playbook. Israel ignored us, unfortunately. They did not listen to us and kind of started its military campaign in Gaza. I can still comprehend why they did that.
Yeah, it's certainly very similar to the United States after 9/11. There was this sense of we have to get them, and it is okay if there are some casualties, some innocent casualties along the way, because we are entitled, we have a right to do whatever it takes. And anyone who is close to Hamas, anyone who's close to the perpetrators, need to get out of the way, and if they don't get out of the way, then that's their responsibility and they might die. That kind of thing, it's destructive thinking, it's bad thinking, but you can understand how that works, right? You can understand the process behind it. One of my concerns about all of this, and for the past year and a half, but certainly now, this weekend, is that continuously, people are attributing some kind of strategic purpose to this, right? People are attributing some strategic interest by Israel. And then the question is, oh, should they do this? Is this right? Is it okay that civilians in Tehran are dying right now because they want to achieve their goals? I don't know. But in the end, of course, Israel needs to be safe. That strategic kind of approach only works if you're talking about a rational strategic actor. And I think that certainly after October 2023, but arguably the evolution of the Israeli government, and before that, the evolution of Israeli society has not been that of a rational actor. It has not been one that simply wants to be safe. Because if your objective is to be safe, you would do something completely different. You would look at ways in which you have stop people wanting to kill you, ways in which you can make sure that there are no young teenagers who are planning to explode bombs in Tel Aviv or elsewhere. You want to look at ways of how a country like Iran stops using violent rhetoric against you. That is the way to be safe in the long term. And yet, that's not what Israel has been doing. Israel has actually increased its insecurity, has increased its perilous position through these violent tactics. Even just the fact that this weekend, 10 people, Israelis died last night, 10 people died, hundreds of people injured by Iranian attacks. How is that making Israel safer? It really isn't. That by definition is a lack of safety. It's a lack of security. And so I think that the whole analysis here should not be about what is Israel strategically trying to accomplish. It should be, why is Israel doing what it's doing? What are the factors that are leading to Israel doing this? And then you look at Netanyahu's personal position, and you look at the sociology and psychology that Israel has been subject to for the past year and a half, but arguably since its very inception, which is a very complex psychology that if Israel were an individual, they would need therapy. They really would.
Well, but isn't their assumption, I mean, so I assume that the government's main target or objective is to keep, is to assure the survival of the state of Israel, right? And to keep Israel safe in that sense. And right, so that kind of explains what they did following the October 7th attack.
But hold on, Dario, why would you assume that? Why is that the assumption?
Because that's what they're saying.
Okay.
Well, I mean, right, it's I mean, I know sometimes we have to read between the lines, but as with the scenarios you basically collected about Iran, I mean, I think the first one we would have to start with Israel is with the most obvious one. That's what they're saying, right? Is that hey, it's our the reason why we were elected, the reason why the state of Israel exists is to keep the Jewish population safe. So if I go with that, and then you think that by right again, and then you kind of have to see, well, if that's your main target, and then okay, what's your strategy based on that? And your strategy is okay, we'll hit back at Hamas, we'll try to like incapacitate Hamas, then we do the same with Hezbollah, right? They did we also recorded an episode about this. They did that last year. And then you kind of right. They also were happy about the developments in Syria, and certainly, are controlling part of Syria now, and are basically controlling the Syrian airspace, which allowed them, which still allows them to kind of fly these attacks against Iran. And if they are truly convinced by the fact that that Iran will follow up on its rhetoric, right, on the annihilation of the Jewish state, then they kind of have to attack Iran. Right, so that's me kind of trying to follow at least what I'm observing, right? Not what I'm analyzing it, and then you would have to ask the question: well, are you actually achieving that? And I think with regards to the regional proxies, at least in the short and medium term, they're no longer a threat to that regard, right? But you already hinted at the possibility of an entire generation being traumatized by Israel's actions against these two actors, right? And maybe you have now teenagers who are growing up hating you and resenting you, and therefore kind of becoming more active with the next generation of these organizations. So you're doing that on the against the regional proxies, and I can still comprehend that strategy if that's it, right? But when it comes to what they're doing with Iran right now, I really don't understand. I can't even comprehend anything they're trying to achieve, because they haven't managed to kind of take out the nuclear program, right? Because it's hidden under, like the nuclear program, right? Not weapons program. it's hidden under a mountain and underneath the earth. You've taken out the scientists, okay, but you've done it in the past with very targeted assassinations as well, so no need to kind of blow up the whole country. And you've taken out the military leadership, however, people can be replaced, right? The whole system is still standing. So here my question is, mostly to the Israelis, but also to you now. I mean, if that's kind of your what's the overall strategy here in the end? Like, what are they trying to achieve in Iran right now?
Yeah, I mean, if I entertain that line of thinking, and again, I think that it's based on an enormous set of faulty assumptions, and there are lots of issues with this structure that you've just presented. But okay, let's go down that line of thought. Then the only thing that I could think of that would actually strategically make sense, but again, I want to point out that I don't think Israel at the moment, certainly not the Netanyahu government, is a strategic, rational actor. But if they were, then the only thing that would make sense is if they somehow have a belief, an indication that this will lead to some kind of revolution within Iran, some kind of overthrow of the Ayatollah, some kind of overthrow of the theocracy, that there is some kind of, that by somehow weakening the military, the Iranian population is going to rise up in anger or feeling that they can no longer be opposed by military oppression. And then will turn Iran into some kind of brilliant pro-Israeli liberal democracy. I mean, that is the only kind of outcome that actually would be counted as a success. Now, I hope that I don't have to explain why that outcome is incredibly, incredibly unlikely. First of all, because by doing this, it's very likely that you're only reinforcing support for the government. I have no idea, and I don't think anyone really properly does. I have no idea how unpopular or how popular the government in Iran actually is. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to actually evaluate that, because it's a complex question. I'm sure there are loads of people who are very uncomfortable with a lot of the aspects within Iranian society, a lot of the harsh, deeply conservative, oppressive nature of the Iranian state, but that doesn't mean that they necessarily want revolution, right? Maybe they just want reform, or they want, you know, there is a sophisticated political structure in Iran where you've got more liberal candidates and more conservative candidates who can become president, who can form a government. On top of that, the moment that Israel starts bombing, all those people who might have a problem with the state will start rallying around the flag. This is not about the Ayatollah. This is about Iran being abused by an outside actor. You are killing our civilians. So I'm certainly now not going to fight my own government. I want my government now to protect us against this evil enemy. And maybe in the future, when things calm down, I will start criticizing the government again. Who knows? So the whole reasoning behind that doesn't seem to make sense. It's the only outcome that would actually make Israel safer, some kind of revolution turning Iran into a pro-Israeli friend. The likelihood of that happening are minimal to none, essentially.
So now the question would be, I mean, again, that's the path that I'm like, at least that you can publicly observe, right? Now the question is, how do they get to this to these wrong impressions, right? And this is, I think, where we enter the Western bubble analysis that we always put forward, is that we're talking about a society, as you already mentioned, that is deeply hurt, deeply traumatized, has, quite frankly, also self-traumatized itself for the last decades, right? By kind of building, like, create this bunker mentality, us against the world, us against everyone. And I'm not saying that this is unjustified, right? I mean, because history shows that, right, that was very justified in the past decades. But you have this deeply traumatized society, and on top of that, you have a current government that is kind of driven by radical ideology, right? So those are the far right-wing factions of the government. You have a prime minister who is mostly driven by personal things, right, such as the corruption trial, such as him always hating Iran and wanting to portray himself as the protector of Israel. So you have all these different elements, right? And I think that they are then a lot more useful to explain the current behavior that we're seeing.
Yeah, and it's important to point out here that trauma itself is not something to judge, right? Trauma is trauma. And so if you have an individual, it's often interesting and useful to think about international relations from an individual perspective, like as if we're talking about human beings that are just acting, because that shows the complex psychology that happens as part of foreign policy making, right? Too often we think about foreign policy as just this strategic, realist thing where there are rational choices that are being made to become more powerful or to weaken your enemy, whereas in reality, foreign policy is a deeply psychological, sociological process. And so if you think about it from as an individual, with Israel being just one human being, imagine your entire family being murdered, because that's essentially what happened during the Holocaust. You are the only survivor, with all the people you loved and cared about gone and horribly annihilated by an evil regime. And now you are given a chance to actually live in a house where you are safe, which has protective walls, where you can make your children grow up without fear of violence. At that moment, you start your life after the death of your family and loved ones with deep, deep trauma. But there's nothing, you know, that doesn't make you a terrible actor. No, in the opposite, we should have empathy for you and we should have sympathy for you. And if then you're given that house, even though that house used to be occupied by other people, then that at that moment is not your problem. You've just lost your entire family. You just want to make sure that your children are going to be okay in the future. So you feel maybe bad for the people who were kicked out of the house, Sure, but you've got other concerns, right? You're still dealing with your pain. You're still dealing with this dark past that you've just survived. And that's essentially Israel in the 1950s, in the 1960s. Now, then on top of that, all your neighbors around you really dislike the fact that you are all of a sudden living there. They don't know you. They don't understand why the old tenants had to go. And you start feeling threatened. Now, very interestingly, psychologically, that if you look at Israel in the 50s and 60s and 70s, yes, they had this horribly complex and at times violent relationship with their surroundings, but they were also hopeful. As the survivors of this horrific crime, Israel was kind of a hippie left-wing society trying to, you know, build a better future for the surviving children. And yet, slowly over time, with the success of basically defending against aggression from neighbors, winning the wars, then establishing a peace accord in 1978, militarily becoming the dominant actor in the region. On top of that, having the almighty protectors of the United States and Europe and others around you, slowly over time, you see Israel turning more conservative, less hopeful, less about a brilliant future, and more about defeating enemies. And that's where that past trauma comes in, right? That has never been properly processed because your entire family was murdered. That trauma of the past is now translated into military success, into power, and it has turned Israel into an abuser against its neighbors, against the people who were there before it came in. And that psychology is fascinating and needs to be understood if you want to understand Israel in 2025. Someone like Netanyahu is a direct consequence of that process, right? Netanyahu would never have been leader in the 1950s or 1960s. People would look at him as an extremist radical. How dare you think about that? We want to create a hopeful, happy future for our children, and we need to protect ourselves against our enemies, but at the same time, we need to find a way to coexist with everyone around us. Now, in the 21st century, Israel has shown that it is militarily untouchable. It has shown that it can do whatever it likes. And now Netanyahu is the answer of a traumatized Israeli society that has tasted power and that has not been challenged seriously over the past 40 years. That is the kind of analysis that should explain this kind of behavior.
And unfortunately, this kind of behavior is going against the original feeling, right? Being in the house and wanting to be safe after experiencing a trauma. Because if we look at the behavior of the last 2 years in particular, and now we look at, does this actually make Israel safer in the short, medium, and long term? I mean, we already answered the question whether it makes them safer in the short term. Last night, 10 people died and hundreds got injured. So that's not good, right? As a direct result of your actions from Friday. In the medium term, I argued in the preparation for this episode, I argued that it does make you a little bit safer because, again, like Hezbollah, Hamas have been weakened, right? Their missiles are basically, have been fired. There's very few left behind. I mean, Hezbollah, according to some reports, even has turned some of them over to the Lebanese army. And you've kind of disrupted the supply of weapons from Iran towards these actors because now you're taking it all the way to Iran. And right, and at some point, I mean, Iran will likely also run out of missiles, right? So in the medium term, I think you can argue that Israel does become safer. What do you think about that?
But then the question is, how do you define safer? In the sense that, will Iran be less capable of striking sending missiles to Israel? Sure, at some point they will run out. At some point, Israeli military operations will have incapacitated them. Sure. I would argue that safer would have been not making sure that Iran doesn't even want to send missiles to your country. That way, nobody dies, nobody gets hurt. And last time I checked, Iran wasn't sending missiles to Israel on Wednesday or Thursday. They only started doing it after Israel took action. One of the best things that Israel did over the past 20 years, and that is something that should get more recognition, and it shows the tragedy of the change over the past 2 years, is actively engaging with anyone who wanted to be engaged with in their region. Basically, a region that was tired of fighting Israel, also because they noticed that Israel was just too powerful, that was too costly. China didn't want any disturbance in the region because China just wants its global infrastructure. The United States was putting pressure on governments. So Israel spent enormous diplomatic capital over the past 20 years to get closer to the Gulf states, leading to the Abraham Accords. Started talking to Saudi Arabia, of all countries. Started engaging with the Lebanese government, with Jordan more actively, with they were on such a diplomatically powerful path that would actually have secured much more safety, much fewer Israeli victims in the long run. And yet, then October 23 happens, and that trauma from the 1940s, that horrific, horrific trauma of having lost 6 million Jewish people through the Holocaust, then gets triggered again, because now the young children are being murdered. And so all the ghosts from the past come back. And all of a sudden, they just go insane. And they say, no, whatever it is that we have to do, we'll have to do it to strike. We need to fight. We need to kill. We need to make sure that our enemies are dead, essentially, which is, of course, a ridiculous way to think about security, because you can kill as many enemies as you like. In the long run, there will only be more enemies standing up against you.
Exactly right, leading us to the long run. And it's almost, it really hurts to see that this is almost page by page the playbook of what Al-Qaeda did to the United States in the early 2000s, right? Is the United States without that past trauma, right? But I think 9/11 was horrific enough to kind of, right, provoke them into this reaction. But it's exactly the same pattern, right? So you were provoked into reaction, you're now overstretching, and it seems like you're doing fine at the moment. Again, in the medium term, you're doing fine. Yeah, you're winning, amazing. But it is costing you so much, right? I mean, militarily, also like lives, right? Just the lives of the soldiers, the lives of the civilians that are being lost. Economically, it is really hurting you. I mean, it's such an expensive operation, right? Militarily, the fact that they need to have their form of the National Guard, right? People aren't working, constant disruptions in your economic cycle. I mean, we talked about in our episode on Spain, right? We talked about how much economic loss there was through basically 12 hour long electricity outage, right? I mean, just imagine how much they're hurting their own economy kind of through all of these actions. And so in the long term, you're really overstretching. You're also losing friends all over the world, right? We talked about this on Friday, how a lot of the Europeans are feeling really, really uncomfortable about Israel's actions. And in the long term, you have become incredibly unsafe, right? You are standing there, maybe still with the United States as your big protector. You're standing there with a kaput economy. Lives have been lost, and you're deeply unpopular within the region. And I'm actually still holding out on kind of making a call on what all these Arab states, right, that you talked about right before, are thinking about all of this, because they are being suspiciously quiet, because, again, they're tired of a region in turmoil. I mean, they're kind of putting out statements saying that, hey, you shouldn't have done that. But you might destroy all that diplomatic success that you've built up over the last 20 years. You might destroy that in an instance.
So that destruction has been taking place since October 23. And it's fascinating, the Arab world, because, of course, Iran has never been a friend of the Arab world. In fact, has been seen as a major rival, both because of ethnicity, history, as well as religion. Yet, you also see that those tensions between Iran and the Arab world over the past 10 years have slowly started easing up. And Saudi Arabia is actually talking to Iran for the first time. So Israel is really misreading the room here. Israel is not understanding the direction of its own region, of the world in that sense. What you just said before, it's exactly why I referenced 9/11 so much. I still remember how in April and May 2023, so many Americans were jubilant because they had invaded Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And the US military obviously was victorious in the first 4 months. Duh. I mean, there was no question about the United States going to defeat the Iraqi armed forces. That, you know, that the there was no surprise there. And all the Americans, look at how powerful we are and look at what a success our government is. Completely unaware that the next 10 years were going to be this horrific, violent civil war, which made the United States struggle in the region, killed Americans, but also completely reduced, eroded American influence worldwide. Cost, according to Stiglitz, over $3 trillion. The long-term patterns are completely being ignored with all of this. And I'm still waiting for someone to give me an answer of, okay, all this cost that you're incurring right now, all this high price that you're paying as Israel in terms of your own population dying, 10 now, maybe tomorrow another 10, who knows, hundreds of people injured, the economic cost, the military cost, the diplomatic cost, the fact that the rest of the world is angrier and angrier and more fed up, that countries have are withdrawing from their previous agreements with you. What are you actually getting out of this? The only explanation could be some kind of revolution in Iran, but why do you think that would happen? And what would that actually lead to? What would be the long-term consequences of that? In fact, I think that your statement before, or it wasn't a question, but essentially it was a rhetorical question, is very, very pertinent. If anything, now Israel has basically given Iran every reason to actually develop nuclear weapons, which, according to you, was the last, according to Israel, was the last thing that Israel wanted to achieve, right? It is a process of deep trauma being triggered by the another trauma in October 2023, making a society essentially losing their minds. And I'm not saying that with any, you know, any dislike for Israel or any sense of anger towards Israel. It's almost sad, right? It is a tragedy of a country that is no longer rationally, reasonably understanding itself, understanding its relations with the rest of the world, and understanding its best interests.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on the Israeli attacks on Iran. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
It's a quote from Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State from the United States, and it goes, "A lot of people think international relations is like a game of chess, but it's not a game of chess where people sit quietly, thinking out their strategy, taking their time between moves. It's more like a game of billiards, with a bunch of balls clustered together."